Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Glad to have you with us and thank you for tuning in. If you are a regular or new listener tuning in for the first time, good to have you with us. My name is Henrik Palmgren and we are coming to you from Sweden, Scandinavia. We are here with a new program every Thursday and Sunday. You can find us around the globe 24/7 through our website redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E creations.com. On our website, you'll find radio archives, a busy news section with interesting, important, upsetting and also positive stories from around the world. I also want to mention that we have a members section containing extended interviews with many of our guests, short films, live feeds, and where you can find our entire and growing radio archive going back to over 2 years now. Today we have with us David Hatcher Childress. He is an explorer, author, and publisher behind Adventures Unlimited Press. Check out his websites, adventuresunlimitedpress.com, that's for the online bookstore, and also wexclub.com, that's wexclub.com. That's the place to go to find out more information about the World Explorers Club that David is behind. David is also one of the speakers on the upcoming Beyond Knowledge conference in Liverpool, and we're going to talk more about that later in the program. We have David back with us on the show today to first discuss the Crystal Skulls. He's coming out with a new book soon, co-authored with Stephen Mailer, entitled The Crystal Skulls, Astonishing Portals to Man's Past. And this is a fascinating topic that kind of gradually is becoming more hot as we move towards the release of the new Indiana Jones movie to be out later this year. In the second segment with David, we're going to talk more about Easter Island and connect this with megalithic structures and lost cities from around the world. So much is to come. Stay tuned. Myself and our listeners, and I know because of the feedback, really enjoyed the last time you were with us, David, so it's a pleasure to welcome you back on Red Ice Creations Radio again.
Yeah, it's good to be back with you. Looking forward to our talk.
Definitely. Thank you again for taking the time in your busy schedule and spending some of it with us here today. I want to begin, I guess, to talk a little bit about the new and upcoming book here that you guys have coming out. And I personally had no idea that Stephen Mailer, who is a co-author to this book, was into these kinds of subjects. I know that he has a background in Egyptology, of course, but how come you guys hooked up together for a project like this?
Well, I've known Stephen for many years, and yes, he is an Egyptologist, and he's best known for his books about Egypt, the land of Osiris, and his second book, From Light into Darkness, which is about the Atenism and Akhenaten and Nefertiti and some of the early history of Egypt. But a lot of people don't know that Stephen Mailer is really also an expert on crystal skulls. He lived in the San Francisco area for many years, although he now lives in Colorado right now. But he was a good friend of Nick Nocerino. Nick has passed away now, but Nick Nocerino, who lived in San Francisco, was probably the greatest expert on crystal skulls who ever lived. He he's profiled in our new book, The Crystal Skulls, and that is a book written, it's really a book in two parts. Part one is written by me, and that section is all basically the history and lore of crystals and crystal skulls, the archaeology. We talk a lot, of course, about the famous Mitchell Hedges crystal skull that was supposedly found in a lost city in Belize,
right?
Lubantun. But we, you know, we're talking about a lot of different crystal skulls, the research, where these crystal skulls would come from. One of the things that's really important about these crystal skulls because even whether ancient civilizations had the technology to right. make these things.
Right.
And that is, that's one of the big questions, something that we do address quite a bit in the book. His part of the book, the second part of the book, features a lot of Nick Nocerino's adventures looking for crystal skulls. Nick would actually pursue crystal skulls that he had heard about. He would literally travel all over the world, running down the owners of crystal skulls, and then he was a very sensitive psychic person. He mm-hmm. he would get some kind of a reading from crystal skulls. He was quite an expert on crystals and crystal skulls, for that matter. So the second part of the book has something of a rundown of the very famous crystal skulls, such as the Max, the Texas crystal skull. There's the famous Amethyst crystal skull. There are crystal skulls in some museums around the world. There's one in Paris at the Trocadero Museum now. That is supposedly an Aztec crystal skull.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a well-known skull in the British Museum. That skull has been off and on display. For many years it was not on display, although the postcard of that crystal skull was the best-selling postcard at the British Museum. And if you go to the gift shop there in London, I've been there many times, and they have a really nice gift shop, but they've told me that that postcard is the best-selling postcard of anything in the museum. And curiously, the crystal skull itself wasn't on display.
Really?
Yet people would still buy this postcard of it.
Okay.
And I, you know, bought it myself several times.
Right, right. Do you know if that... Because if we're thinking of the same skull here, I know that it has been on display as a fake for some time, but then it has been, you know, removed and kind of back and forth, as you say. But, I mean, do you know if they have been able to determine, or if you guys have been able to determine if this is the real thing, so to speak?
Well, I mean, this is the big question, really, about many of the crystal skulls, particularly the really large, life-size crystal skulls, like the one in the British Museum. They have put it back on display now because of the intense demand by the public to see these things.
Right.
Because they are remarkable. It's one of the funny things about crystal skulls is that they're absolutely real. I mean, there's just no question that these things are made of quartz crystal, which is extremely hard stone. I mean, only diamonds and a few other jewels like that are actually harder than quartz crystal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the big questions that the British Museum had, the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., they also had a crystal skull that was donated to them. It allegedly also came out of Mexico, and there was allegedly a collection of crystal skulls from the 1800s that was owned by the president of Mexico, Porfirio Diaz.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people aren't that aware of you know, Mexico's rather turbulent history, particularly in the 1800s and the early part of the 1900s, where Mexico went through this number of revolutions. You have Pancho Villa and Zapata guys running around. Even the American military got involved and invaded Mexico at one point. But during those years, the late 1800s up to 1913, the president of Mexico was Porfirio Diaz, and he was part Mixtec. He was from southern Mexico, from the Oaxaca area. And that area is, in fact, as we talk about in our book, The Crystal Skulls, that area of southern Mexico, south of Mexico City, around Monte Albán, Mitla, the main town there is Oaxaca. That area is where the Zapotecs and the Mixtecs lived, and they were the special artisans. And even the Aztec rulers used Mixtecs and Zapotec artisans. These were the jewelers. They were the gold artisans, and they were the guys too who carved crystals and made crystal skulls. The big question, and this is what the British Museum was looking at, the Smithsonian, the Mitchell Hedges skull has been studied this way, is you have these really remarkable, very large crystal skulls. And if you look at the British Museum crystal skull or the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, they are not only nearly life-size pieces of very pure, clear crystal, I mean, almost perfectly translucent, just to get a really large, you know, almost perfectly clear crystal that size would be difficult, just for starters.
Right.
And then to actually carve it into, you know, a life-size skull, I mean, this becomes really a job for someone who is incredibly skilled and would have to have special tools, including like diamond drills and diamond-tipped saws. And this is what they were looking at, the Smithsonian and the British Museum, as they started to look at some of these crystal skulls. You know, the question that came to their mind was, well, if this is really an Aztec crystal skull, the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull was said to be a Mayan crystal skull.
Yeah.
And they wondered, I mean, the big thing that came up with them, which they hadn't really thought of back in, you know, 1886, when like the London British Museum crystal skull was acquired, the Paris Museum crystal skull was acquired around that same time. You know, they said, yeah, you know, this is an Aztec crystal skull. This is a Mayan crystal skull. But later, as they looked into the how these things could be carved, what it would take to carve them, polish them. And the question that they had was, well, did the Aztecs or the Mayans actually have the tools to make these things?
Yeah.
And they kept looking for power tool marks, things like that, something that would indicate that they had been made with crude tools or advanced tools. And what they decided in the end, that the British Museum and the Smithsonian, was that the British Museum crystal skull and the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull had been carved not with primitive tools, but with fairly modern tools. And this, of course, raised a big red flag to them, because they had assumed and had, in good faith, purchased these crystal skulls in the late 1800s as authentic Aztec or perhaps Mayan, although now people do not think that there were very many Mayan crystal skulls, if any. But they started having serious doubts that these were, that those crystal skulls anyway were somehow authentic ancient skulls that had been carved 1,000 years ago or something like that.
Very interesting. And, you know, I would like to pick up on a few notes that you mentioned there, especially regarding Mexico, and I'm going to return to that a bit later there. But I want to mention before that in a recent story from Archaeology, that their website is archaeology.org, I think, a story written by Jane McLaren Walsh. The title of the story was Legend of the Crystal Skulls, a fairly recent story. And
I
basically,
did. I saw that article.
you did, I mean, the entire subject is basically debunked in that article. Basically, I guess they refer to this because they've done testing on a few that I would guess at this point is actually a crappy few fakes of these that kind of came onto the scene during the second half of the 19th century, and they began to surface. And of course, what they determined to be a fake is those who have clear evidence of, as you say, kind of tool marks on them. But that does not necessarily mean, though, that those are fake, because if we just take into account what you mentioned, that if indeed these people back there in South America, the Mayans, Aztecs, etc., had these kinds of tools, then it doesn't mean that it's a fake, but it's actually a real thing. So is it possible, do you think, at all to determine the age of these crystal skulls at all?
Well, I mean, that's one of the problems with crystal skulls, isn't that because they're carved out of quartz crystal, you cannot, there's no way to really date them unless, like, you could find the origin. If you could find the maker and even like an invoice or something to somebody saying, "Yeah, I made this crystal skull for you. Here's your bill." Blah, blah, blah. They think that these crystal skulls, like the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, the one in at the British Museum, they think now that they were made in Germany and that they were made by there's a couple of special towns in Germany that specialize in crystal carving. We're talking about, say, 1860 or so, this time. They did have power tools. They had diamond drills and saws. They could cut, they could polish the skulls. And yeah, that article that you're talking about, by Walsh, she works for the Smithsonian Institution, and because of this new Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull movie that's coming out, I mean, there's already an intense interest in these skulls. By the way, I mean, one of the curious things going on here in this whole debate about the crystal skulls, who made them, how authentic they are, the one in Paris, the Parisians insist that that is not a modern fake. They insist that it is an Aztec crystal skull. So now you have the Smithsonian and the British Museum saying, "No, these things are, they're not 1,000 years old or more. They're only, well, maybe 150 years old, something like that." But in Paris, they're saying, "No, this is really an Aztec crystal skull." If you go to museums in Mexico, you will see crystal skulls, in the museums. The main museum in Mexico City, I was just there a couple of months ago. And that's a great museum. Lot of cool stuff to see and unusual things. And you will see some crystal skulls in there. They're not life-size, though. They're much smaller, just a few inches high. They are carved out of quartz crystal. I mean, we say in our book that the Aztecs probably themselves weren't able to make crystal skulls, but the Mixtecs and Zapotecs apparently were. In my book that came out last year on the mystery of the Olmecs, I show in that book that nearly everything that is ascribed to the Mayans, whether it's the calendar, the writing system, the number system, building the pyramids, even the ball games and the rubber balls and things like that, that all that really originated with the Olmecs. And the Olmecs apparently had a pretty high technology. Mm. When I was on your show before, we talked about my book, Technology of the Gods.
Right.
And like you were saying earlier, a lot of what that has to do with is that ancient civilizations did have, you know, some pretty high technology, including drills. I maintain that at points they had electricity. They certainly had hardened metals. They were capable of carving very hard stones like basalt. You have in Mexico these colossal Olmec heads. They're 20 tons. They're carved out of basalt, which is extremely hard stone. Quartz crystal is harder and more difficult to carve.
Mm.
But yeah, so, I mean, this goes back to what you were kind of saying was the Smithsonian and the British Museum, they're basically looking at the crystal skulls, seeing that whoever carved them did have access to some very hard tools. I mean, even they say that you would need diamond-tipped tools to create these things. Well, they naturally assume that the Aztecs and the Mayans didn't have that kind of stuff. In fact, I mean, one of the weird things with the Mayans is that the Mayans were thought to really not even have normal metal tools, like as they had in South America or existed, say, in the Middle East and Europe at that time. But the Mayans didn't have those things.
Right.
They might have had some soft copper tools. The Mayans typically used obsidian and flint knives. They didn't use a lot of metals. So that causes a problem where if the Mayans didn't have metals or the tools to carve crystal and make crystal skulls, such as the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, as an example, then, you know, who could have made these things? Well, they naturally think that they had to be modern forgeries. And there is, I mean, there's some evidence to that. And I don't totally disagree with them that some of these crystal skulls are made somehow in Europe, perhaps, actually in Mexico, but were made, you know, in the late 1800s.
Right, right. You know, can I pick up on that? Because there was actually one very interesting thing that I thought, at least, in the archaeology article that they brought out, and that has to do with the potential origins on some of the skulls and the connection with the French guy called Eugene Boban that was around
Boban,
in there.
That's right, yeah. And we do talk about him in our book, too, of course.
You do, okay. Yeah, because this was what they had to say. I'm just going to read two paragraphs from the article here, and that's it says, the first Mexican crystal skulls made their debut just before the 1863 French intervention, when Louis Napoleon's army invaded the country and installed, this is interesting, Maximilian von Habsburg of Austria as emperor of Mexico then. Two other examples of crystal skulls were exhibited in 1867 at the Exposition Universelle in Paris as part of the collection of Eugene Boban. Perhaps the most mysterious figure in the history of crystal skulls, a Frenchman who served as the official archaeologist of the Mexican court of Maximilian von Habsburg. And Boban was also a member of the French Scientific Commission in Mexico, whose work the Paris Exposition was designed to highlight. And the article goes on to say, one small crystal skull was purchased in 1874 for 28 pesos by Mexico City's National Museum for the Mexican collector Louis Costantino, and another for 30 pesos in 1880. In 1886, the Smithsonian bought a small crystal skull, this one from the collection of Augustine Fischer, who had been Emperor Maximilian's secretary in Mexico, but disappeared mysteriously from the collection sometime after 1973. It had been on display in the exhibition of archaeological fakes after William Fosshag, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, a Smithsonian mineralogist realized in the 1950s that it had been carved with modern lapidary wheel. So with those paragraphs in mind, what about we entertain the idea that some, potentially some of the crystal skulls actually were created by, because as you say, if you highlighted the fact that they potentially were done in Germany, so what if Maximilian von Habsburg actually brought some of those to Mexico and began to surface them around that area, maybe not to, you know, earn money or something, because they were sold very cheaply, but maybe because they either wanted to discredit the subject of the real ones that were there, or potentially even flooding actually the market with fake skulls to actually kind of, you know, the real ones would be kind of forgotten or lost among on all the fake ones. What do you think about that, David?
Well, right. I mean, I think you're on the right track there, and that's the way the British Museum and the Smithsonian were thinking about it. I mean, it's curious that the Paris archaeologists, you know, are still wanting to believe that the skull they got, probably from also Eugene Bobon, is really an authentic Aztec skull. What I would say along your lines, just a little bit differently though, is that, you know, crystal skulls do exist in Mexico. The Aztecs did have them, the Mixtecs, the Zapotecs, probably the Olmecs before them. I mean, both the Zapotecs and the Mixtecs are basically direct descendants of the mysterious Olmecs. And the Olmecs apparently did have pretty high technology. Were able to carve basalt and crystal and stuff like that. So crystal skulls did absolutely exist. And the Mexicans have always been fascinated by them. If you go to Mexico, you'll see skull motifs everywhere. They have the whole Day of the Dead celebration. Skull type of iconography, and whether ceramic and made out of stone, just painted on walls, that's very, very common down there.
Yeah.
It is said that the two countries in the world that really use the skull motif the most are Mexico and Tibet.
Right, right.
And you have also there are Tibetan crystal skulls, and from the Himalayas, there are collections of those as well. Again, you've got to stress that making anything out of quartz crystal, including a crystal skull, is difficult. I mean, you've chosen one of the most difficult and hard materials to try and work with.
Mm, yeah.
The Greeks thought that crystals, quartz crystals, were a special kind of super frozen ice. But here's probably what was going on. In Mexico, yeah, and it does have a lot to do with Maximilian and the Habsburgs, the French trying to take over Mexico and run it as an empire.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something going on there, apparently, where crystal skulls and the authentic ones that they may have had, and the Mexican emperors, they, like crystal balls, they may have been some kind of magical oracle that priests, and including these emperors and the high officials, they may have wanted crystal skulls as talismans, symbols of power, even as some kind of occult, you know, windows to the future to help them rule the country effectively and retain their power, stuff like that.
There you go. Yeah, like an obsidian sky ring like John Dee and the guys had back when, you know.
That's right. And, you know, that was very big in Mexico, too. And in Peru, many of these societies where, yeah, you're looking into obsidian mirrors, same like crystal balls, other unusual things like this. And crystals have this power. I mean, you can see why quartz crystal is used. And the early chapters in our book, The Crystal Skulls, we go into that, how amazing and high-tech quartz crystals are. They're used today in all kinds of high-tech things, from watches, atomic clocks. Even NASA goes into space and tries to grow crystals in space so that they'll have pure quartz crystals.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's the idea with Eugene Bobon, and that some of these crystal skulls are made in Germany, that the Maximilian and these French, Austrian emperors, they, and we don't know why exactly, but they perhaps commissioned these life-size, very pure, just they're perfect in a sense, crystal skulls, and they were made in Germany, and we don't know how many were made. The Smithsonian has identified 4 or 5, and perhaps more. Although it seems like they're sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as we say,
Yeah. Where
they found a few what they believe are modern crystal skulls, and they're sort of like saying, well, you know, this is the answer to the whole mystery. Hmm. I would say that's wrong.
Yeah.
But so some of these crystal skulls, including the British Museum one, probably the Mitchell Hedges one too, were made in Germany, then taken to Mexico. And rather than originally being some kind of fakes that were then going to be resold to museums, apparently they were the property of these high officials who now were, in many cases, French or Austrian. They were European transplants who had come to Mexico, try to create a new empire in a rather chaotic country, too.
Yeah.
And so now you have these high officials with a mixture, I would say, of authentic Aztec, Mixtec, Zapotec crystal skulls. Many of these may have been really quite small, not life-size. But now you could add to their collection of genuinely old crystal skulls some of these newer ones. And the newer ones were larger, probably made out of Brazilian crystal that had been then sent to Germany, turned into a crystal skull. Even with modern type saws and machining, would still take many, many months to create these crystal skulls, but not hundreds of years. And this is one of the things, too, when guys like Frank Dorland in the late 1960s, he studied in San Francisco the Mitchell Hedges skull. He believed that the Mitchell Hedges skull was really found in Lubantin, this lost city in Belize.
Mm-hmm.
He thought that somehow the Mayans really had made it. He could not find modern tool marks, although apparently on one of the teeth of the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, there are some scratches that appear to be from a power tool.
Hmm.
So he thought, but he genuinely thought that the Mayans had somehow made this, but he assumed, of course, then too, that they had to use relatively primitive tools to do this. And so he then calculated that it would have taken 200 or 300 years
make
this thing slowly, polishing it with sand and a leather rag, trying to make it smooth. I mean, it just, it's mind-boggling, the effort that they would have allegedly had to make.
Right, right.
You know. So now you have, it incorporates, I think, all of these studies where, yes, there are genuine ancient crystal skulls. They're real. We don't really know how they carve those. They're in museums now in Mexico and Guatemala and other areas. Then you have some of these German-made ones. They're the ones that are the more famous ones because they're very large.
Mm-hmm.
And they're almost exactly the size of a human skull. The Mitchell Hedges one has this movable jawbone beneath it. One of the other things in the Mitchell Hedges skull that's unusual is that it has drilled holes in the base of the skull. And those holes would then apparently have had some kind of wooden or metal rods inserted into the base of the skull. Hmm. And that skull, I mean, it's quite a unique skull, and it's bizarre, ultimately.
Right.
That skull could have sat on some altar, could have been lit from below. I mean, that skull had special light wells and what they call light pipes built into it that would channel the light and make it come out the eyes. It was specially made that it glowed and had a certain kind of occult presence to it and an aura. If you saw it, and the eyes would be glowing at you. And then on top of that, with these rods in the base of the skull inserted, you could manipulate the skull. And for instance, say a priest could be underneath the altar, underneath the floor of some temple, mm-hmm. manipulating these rods. And what would happen is the skull would appear to be talking to you.
Right, right.
And get this, as some kind of special priesthood fraud, in a sense, you might have a temple, perhaps a Mayan temple or Aztec temple or something. The priests bring a person one at a time into the interior of this temple. The priest stands there. You are looking at this crystal skull on top of an altar. It's lit up and glowing. The eyes are glowing at you. It's life size. You're quite amazed at this. And then it starts talking to you.
Right.
And the mouth is moving, and it's in theory the skull can't really say anything. But, say, a priest underneath who's manipulating it, he starts talking, and he becomes the voice of the skull.
Right, right. You know,
so you are, as some, you know, just uninformed peasant who's been brought into this temple, you're totally blown away. I mean, you can't believe it, what you're seeing. But it's right there in front of you.
Right, right.
And here is a talking human head. It's all lit up and glowing. Its mouth is moving.
Yeah.
And, you know, words are coming out of it. And, I mean, you are really genuinely impressed and probably frightened. Who knows what the crystal skull might tell you at that point.
Right.
one thing it might tell you is to give lots of money to the priests, you know, as you leave the temple, something like that.
There you go. Perfect for creating a new religion or something right there.
Well, right. And the crystal skulls, particularly the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, is perfectly made for something like that.
Yeah,
and in fact, I mean, as they studied it, that's one of the main things they noticed was that, yeah, this thing was made to talk. But now here's the other thing, as we get into the technology here,
mm-hmm.
for these two holes at the base of the skull to have been made, I mean, they are just, you know, like a barely a centimeter in diameter or something, or less, and they go 4 or 5 centimeters up into the base of the skull, and they're perfectly round holes to slip some kind of wooden or steel rod. To make that into a crystal skull, to drill a hole like that, you would basically need some kind of power tool. I mean, it almost couldn't be done otherwise.
Right, right.
Frank Dorland, who studied the skull, the Mitchell Hedges skull in the 60s in San Francisco, I mean, he was aware of all this, and, you know, he of course knew about these holes at the base of the skull, but how they could have made those, he was unable to figure out. And, I mean, that's why he was saying it took him hundreds of years. But if you have diamond-tipped drills and things, I mean, then it all becomes quite possible. And certainly they had those in Germany. But, I mean, once again, did the Zapotecs, the Olmecs, did they have this kind of a thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a curious thing, too, when you look at crystal skulls in Mexico and you go back to the Himalayas and to Tibet. These tantric who live in the Himalayas. This is, so we're talking now northern India and Tibet. These guys, their, you know, skulls and crystal skulls were a big thing there. They are real.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's one of the things about crystal skulls, is that crystal skulls are absolutely real. I mean, they exist. It's when they were made and how they were made is the question.
Indeed.
But you do have these ones in Tibet and India.
Hmm.
Now, there's a strong connection, really, between ancient India and Tibet and Mexico and the Americas. Many archaeologists, of course, don't think that. They are isolationists. They believe that ancient civilizations are all isolated from each other.
Right, right.
There's not some transoceanic traffic. But I show in my book on Mystery of the Olmecs that a lot of what was going on in ancient Mexico was a trans-Pacific trade that was coming, in fact, from ancient India and Southeast Asia across the Pacific. They were using Tonga, Easter Island, Tahiti, and then landing in Mexico, also in Peru.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's quite possible that ultimately the whole crystal skull mania that's popularly associated with Mexico ultimately is coming from ancient India and Tibet and the Himalayas. How about that?
Right. Well, that's very interesting, and again, that supports the idea. And I'm all in favor for that general idea of you know, a global seafaring people that basically was around the planet at that time. I just want to squeeze in here, David, and ask you about your comment on this, that if we return and talk about the kind of occult aspect to this, if you will, the subtitle, of course, of your book is Astonishing Portals to Man's Past, and that's an interesting use of a word there, because if we talk about portals or even transport, quartz crystal, of course, is obviously a medium for communication, because if we just think back of the first radio receivers, we had quartz crystal in those. So it's obvious.
That's right, and there are the crystal radio sets you can use where you don't even need batteries and things.
That's right.
But you need a quartz crystal. Quartz crystals are very high tech. I mean, they were known in ancient times. Ancient people did use quartz crystals. And even just a normal crystal, one that's not carved, was often part of a shaman's bag of tricks, the medicine man. If you go to many museums in the Americas, in South America, in Mexico, even in the United States, they will show you quartz crystals as part of what they find. Magic mushrooms are part of this too.
Indeed.
Jade artifacts, the Quetzal feathers. These people also use boomerangs and other kind of unusual weapons and things like that.
Yeah.
So you start to see a trace there. But crystals are really important. You can, like a CD or a DVD, you can store information in them.
There we go.
And then use lasers and things like that. It's one of the things they say about crystal skulls and any crystal object is that over time it will take on certain energies and vibrations of the people around it. And like a DVD or something, it stores information, and that information can later be accessed by other people if they do it right.
Well, exactly, and that opens up the you know, a can of worms, so to speak, and I guess we don't have time to go into all of that in this segment here, because we need to begin to round things off, but just to squeeze this in here, that this could potentially, and I've heard this before, that the crystal skulls, or some of them then, actually contain information about this previous civilization, and they actually stored in the skulls information about how they lived, what, you know, where their civilization were, etc., etc., and even potentially how it was, you know, destroyed, or what happened during the end period of their era, so to speak. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sure, exactly like that. I mean, the idea of halls of records, of some kind of Atlantean library of information. This could, and it would make sense that this information would be stored inside crystals, inside a crystal skull, inside a crystal ball, even just inside a very large, good quartz crystal. If you look at the Superman comic books and movies, part of the mythology there is that Superman has this fortress of solitude up in the Arctic, where this is his secret, inside a mountain base or something like that. And for him, when he's there in his fortress of solitude, to access information from his home planet, he puts these giant quartz crystals into like a little base receptacle. And when he does that, because the information is stored in these quartz crystals, then suddenly, you know, he's accessing this giant encyclopedia from his home planet. And that makes total sense. You could do that. And in fact, I mean, storing things inside a quartz crystal is much better than storing them inside some little plastic CD or DVD that can easily be broken scratched or something.
They wear down eventually, but these things, they last through time, you know?
That's right. I mean, quartz crystals are so hard. They're nearly indestructible, but they can be destroyed because quartz can shatter, and it's very brittle. If you took your crystal skull and threw it hard against the wall, you could break it, although it's almost impossible to scratch them, or if you take out your pocket knife and try and scratch your crystal or crystal skull, you can't really do it.
Yeah. David, to begin to round things up here for our first segment, for those who are interested in getting a copy of your new book that you've co-authored together with Stephen Mailer, is it available yet, when it's going to be out?
You know, it should be out in mid-May, and it's up on our web pages now at adventuresunlimitedpress.com. You can order a copy, and it will be in bookstores in Europe and America probably by June, I would think. And we did push quite hard to get this book out in time for the movie because we realized that the subject of crystal skulls will be quite popular this summer.
That's right, that's right. The website again is adventuresunlimitedpress.com, and also check out JB's other website, wexclub.com. That's wexclub.com. Also want to squeeze in here in this segment, upcoming conference, of course. With David, he will be attending the Beyond Knowledge Conference in Liverpool, England. That's the 3rd and 4th of May. So if you're interested in hearing David speak or some of the other researchers there, like Michael Tessarion, Marcus Allen, Jerry E. Smith, Ken Thomas, Ralph Ellis, Ian Crane, or David Griffin, you need to pop on over to their website for much more information about tickets, time, and so on. The website is beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Again, that's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. And as I said, David's going to be there. So what are you going to talk about on that conference, David?
You know, I will be giving my sort of standard presentation that will be about ancient technology, Atlantis. I take people on a roller coaster ride around the world to unusual sites. We'll even talk about the crystal skulls while I'm there. Wow. It'll be fun. I hope that some of your listeners will attend.
Yeah, definitely. And do you know which one of the 2 days you'll be speaking on?
Yeah, I think I'm there on Saturday.
Saturday
afternoon, first day.
The third, yeah, okay, yeah. And myself and Frigg is going to be there also, not to do a talk or anything like that, but definitely meet up with some of the researchers and listen to their fascinating talks. So that's going to be definitely a lot of fun. But we'll do like this, that we're going to take a short break right here and continue talking with David in our member section and get into a little bit more about the Easter Island, megalithic structures, and lost cities from around the world. So stay with us, David, and we'll be right back after this break.